You're now listening to Sound Talent Media. Check out more shows at soundtalentmedia.com.
So this is Catch 22, so you're going to get it from either age group, but I'd rather get the vicious talent of a 25-year-old monster, you know what I mean? And so I you know, all the guys in the band are in their mid-20s to early 30s, and you know, they're younger than the music they're playing, but they play it better than we played it. I mean, they honestly, you know, and it's not a slight on the original band, it's just that we had a lot of problems, you know, the original guys. You know, Rand was a tremendous guitar player, but some, not always. You know, not if he had a bad night, you know what I mean? And he was kind of sloppier. Today's musicians are just more disciplined, so there's less slop.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Matt here from Cryptopsy and the host of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast. I hope that you had a killer weekend. I most certainly did. This Vox and Hops episode is presented by Heavy Montreal. Heavy Montreal are Montreal's premier metal promoter. And if you are ever in Montreal, trust me when I say this, if you are looking for a killer show to go to, Heavy Montreal will have you covered. I am beyond stoked to have Heavy Montreal behind the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast. Now, before we jump into today's episode, I'd just like to ask you to follow the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast on the podcast platform of your choice. But more than that, I would love for you to tell a friend about the podcast. If there's someone in your life that just loves extreme music and loves craft beer, well, you should definitely let them know that the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast exists. You could tell them that there are over 400 episodes where I sit down with some of the world's best metal musicians. We talk all about their lives and music while enjoying craft beers. If you would encourage one of your metalhead beer loving friends to become a brand new Vox and Hops head, that would be something that I would truly appreciate. This week on the podcast, I'm very stoked to be with Kelly Schaefer of Atheist and Till the Dirt. Get ready, everyone. This is Vox and Hops episode number 442.
I warn you, what you are about to hear is very disturbing indeed.
Hey, what's up, everyone? Today, I'm very stoked to be with Kelly Schaefer of Atheist and Till the Dirt. Kelly, very stoked to be hanging out with you because we are doing something cool coming up. We're actually going on tour together in a little bit more than 2 months at this point, a little bit less than 2 months. And we've sort of met a long time ago. I can't remember quite when. And it was like 2010s, 2012, 2014, something around then. But, you know,
yeah, it was right after, right after we did Jupiter 2010. We played a festival.
Exactly.
How do you say that festival? How do you pronounce it?
It was Trois-Rivières Metal Fest.
Yeah, you have to have a little French in
you.
You
gotta have
to be
a little,
able to pronounce
a little roll in your R's there. To have the opportunity to use the podcast or something like this, where I could sit down with someone and get to know them a little better before living on the road with them for a month, is something that I'm extremely grateful for. So I said, why not? Let's do this. And it's, you know, it's early 2024. I've been on holiday break for a few weeks and jumping back and doing interviews.
Happy New Year to everybody! Happy New Year!
Hell yeah, man!
Ready for
and,
a new,
it makes
yeah.
me real, real happy. So let's just start with a very simple. How are you doing?
I'm fabulous. I just nice big drink of my Jaeger, which we were just chuckling about. yeah, just, you know, glad to head into the new year. Was happy with last year. Last year was a lot of fun, but it's always good to have a fresh new set of sheets, you know. And and especially with news right at the top of the year. So
hell yeah,
really, really looking forward to digging into it.
Just jumping straight back onto tour. I love it. And you know, it is Vox and Hops. Typically, I hang out with my metal friends who talk about their lives and music while drinking craft beer. But you yourself, you're enjoying your poison of choice, which is,
yes, everyone who knows me knows that Jägermeister is my poison of choice. Jäger bombs, preferably Red Bull. So it's something I've drank for. I was actually sponsored by them when I was in Neurotica, and
really,
2002 we run Ozfest, and so I would wake up on the bus every day. There would be a bottle of Jaeger and a bottle of Grey Goose
because
Cindy Frank was the promoter, and so that's where it began. And mix a little Red Bull in it, and it kind of. I just always know how much I can drink, you know, like
that's, I've
had three, because you know what I mean? If you dip between beer, like if you have three beers and then a shot of tequila and then two really good craft beers, all of a sudden you're fucking up, you know, you're like, oh man. And once you've gone over the edge, you can't go back. So I learned a long time ago as an elder statesman, I can monitor my, my rise throughout the evening, you know.
Well, I will follow in your footsteps on tour, and hopefully you can pupil me to better learn my limits. Tonight, hypothetically, might not do that because I'm drinking a big beer. This is from Brasserie Harry Canna here in Montreal. It's a collab that was given to me by my good friend Jack. He runs a craft beer store that's been open for 10 years here in Montreal, and he did a collab. He did a bunch of collabs to celebrate his 10th anniversary. And this is their 5411, and it's a quadruple Belgian quad style brew that they aged in Porto barrels, and it's an 11.8, which typically means that it's over 12% here in Quebec. Shit. And Jack's a cool guy. I toured in the States for the first time. He was doing merch for Cryptopsy, and he's been doing this for the past 10 years. So wow. Cheers to Jack, and cheers to a long life of his craft beer store, which is called Frigo de Bacchus.
That's a thing with craft beer that you could teach me about it, you know, because I bartended for a while, but it was kind of in the period where craft beer was just kind of emerging. But I did, in that short time, find that you have to be really careful which beer you're having. Yes. And also, I remember years ago, the difference between American beer and you know, like touring in Europe in the early 90s. You get over there and you get a case of, or more of whatever beer. Like, we toured with Benediction in 1993, and those boys can drink, man. And they got six cases of beer, like, you know, huge bottles, and they were just, you know, they didn't even put them in the fridge or anything. You just drank it at room temperature. And yeah, like, significantly different than growing up American and drinking beer flavored water, essentially, is what we have here. You know, it's gotten, I guess, a little better over the years, but back in the day.
Totally. But there's always that mythic thing that I would always hear, oh, you're from Canada, so the beer is stronger.
It's, well, that's what I always thought. I mean, that's what I always found as well.
Typically, in the States, it ranges between 4% and 5%, especially if you're going for those big market beers, the Buds,
I think there was a law at some point that got lifted, and that's why the beers got a little bit better here. I remember maybe somewhere in the 90s, they allowed a little more percentage on the beer. But yeah, I'll have to you'll have to school me on that while we're out on the road. You know,
with great pleasure.
And cheers, man.
Cheers to you.
It's gonna be great. Looking forward to it. So, what kind of stuff are you doing out? Are you doing, how much are you doing from the new album?
We are doing a lot. This discussion that we keep having is, what is the acceptable amount of new material you can play nowadays? And
what do you think as a fan, when you go see a band that you love, how much of that?
Because that's the tricky answer, isn't it? Discussion, yeah. Right there. Exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, typically Dee Snider calls the new songs the bathroom breaks. That's when everyone will step up and walk to the bathroom.
Well,
sometimes.
That's because he wrote them, you know. I'm sorry. No, I mean, you know, we're not all writing fucking, you know, bathroom break songs, man. What the fuck? You know,
we've always play a lot of Nuns of Vile, and with Blasphemy Made Flesh celebrating an anniversary in 2024, we're definitely going to do some heavily focused Blasphemy Made Flesh songs. Something that we have discovered is that we want to play songs that have a lot more melody and groove aspects to them. So we've been digging through the catalog, hoping to dig out some of those, which might push some certain albums out of the way for the time being until we celebrate those. But
it's hard because it's like going on vacation and only taking some of your kids.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
It's impossible.
Like, it's really hard to pick a set list, you know, and these days, you know, you can readily see people's either gratefulness or dismay at your choice. You know, whereas back in the day, you just play and you dipped out of town and you never heard about it anymore. You read the Instagram the next day, and they're like, they didn't fucking play this, and they didn't play. It's like, you know, how long can we play? You know, we were doing, on the Cynic thing, almost 90 minutes. And
wow. Okay.
Yeah, man, we did like 18 shows in a row in 90 minutes, and I was like, wow. You know, I was like, that felt so good, because our whole career was always like 45-minute slots. You know what I mean? And never, you got to quickly get through. If you want to get 10 songs in, you got to not talk any shit in between songs. You know, yeah, it's really hard. So it was nice to just relax and play all the songs that we wanted to play. And and this time, I guess we're not going to get to play quite that long. But it's fun. That was the first time. Have you ever had to do those kind of sets? 90 minutes.
We typically draw a line around 70 minutes. Flo sort of.
I think that's a smart move.
Has a threshold that he likes to keep within, and he thinks that he's fed people enough. In Japan just recently, our FOH was really pushing us to stretch things out, but I just sort of did a lot longer speeches. I felt like Bob Barker at moments, just rambling on to the crowd.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I mean, that must be difficult, actually, over there, because I talk very fast. So you really have to, like,
that's exactly
slow
what
down
I do.
To talk to them. And it almost sounds condescending, but it's the way it has to be.
So that they can, everyone can understand exactly what the message
they're
trying to get
across.
About,
I think we've all learned from Rob Halford and Dickinson that it's all about inflection. You could be
true.
Like,
you could say anything.
You know, and then as soon as they hear the, yeah, you know, then they're like, rah.
That's true.
Even if they don't know what the fuck you said, you know, they can at least react, you know.
It's true. Take me back to beer. Do you remember your first beer? Can you bring me back to that first experience that you had with beer, that first liquid water there?
Yeah, and it was probably like an old Milwaukee.
Mm. That was actually early one of mine, too, actually. It was an old Milwaukee up here in Montreal.
It might have been a Busch beer. One of those two, though, definitely. And in the early stages of going to school and drinking beer, it was whatever we could get somebody to buy for us.
Exactly.
So a lot of times it became Bud. You know, there wasn't really a Bud Light thing back then. It was all straight Budweiser. And then in Florida, this brand came out called Ice House, which was really kind of good. And then Coors. Actually, there was a period of time where Coors beer wasn't able to... they weren't able to sell it on the East Coast.
Interesting.
East of the Rockies for some reason.
Interesting.
And I remember that being a big deal. We were in high school. I was probably, 10th grade. And I was going to, like, a performing arts school. And we had the last 2 days of school, and Coors had just became available. And we grabbed a couple of cases of it. And it really tasted amazing. It tasted... you know, way different than Busch and Budweiser. But I think about it now, and I just think, beer's come so far, you know, since those days. I mean, I'm 55. So it was in the late 80s, mid-80s, late 80s. The beer drinker these days shouldn't feel so... shouldn't feel like the underbelly as they would back in the day. You know what I mean? Like, these days you can be an elitist beer drinker.
Unbelievably so, and I will show you all about that. But albeit in exactly, it's really transformed into something like that. Although Flo did capture a few pictures of me, and I'll be honest, and I'll say it on the podcast, at Mexico Metal Fest, where I was drinking a Coors Light, and he made me pose for an illicit picture with it, just because Coors Light, exactly, Coors Light is Flo's nectar of choice. How about
all of your friends with little tiny ponytails are upset with. You know, back at the beer plate.
And the big beard. Take me to discovering Jägermeister and that experience. And was it really on that Ozfest, or was it before that? When did all all come together?
Well, yeah, so it kind of all... it happened a little before Ozfest. When Neurotica, before we got signed, I hung out at this bar. I live in Sarasota, Florida, which is right on the west coast of Florida, right on the beach. And there was a bar there called Gilligan's. And the owner was a friend of mine. And he was just this really great guy. And he became one of the first places in the country to sell Jaeger with Red Bull. Because Red Bull was just kind of emerging as well as a brand, so it would probably be more in the year 2000, and so inevitably we ended up signing with the WWE and Vince McMahon and signed this big deal, and we're going out on Ozfest, and so we got a Jaeger endorsement, and there was a guy named Rick Zeiler there, and he was the guy who was in charge, and he was just a really great guy, and they used to make posters for our shows. Give us shot glasses and anything we want, any kind of swag, we want it for free. Mm-hmm. It was such a great deal. Jaeger was so supportive back then.
So these taps, too, back in the day, these cold taps where you put the bottles in upside down there. I know that they endorsed some Canadian bands and they did that.
Well, they would put our band names on anything we wanted.
That's so
anyway,
cool.
But as long as Jaeger was on the other side, mm-hmm. you know, and... I mean, if you think about that today, nobody really stretches out for local. They would do this with local bands, unsigned bands as well. So we just happened to get signed. And so when we got signed, I called Zeiler and I was like, can you, and they were already sponsoring the tour. So, or co-sponsoring it. And so then every day we were just like hooked up and they had a big party at Zeiler's mansion in San Diego at the end of the tour. And good times. Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And so I guess I feel a sense of brand loyalty. You know, they were there early in my career, and
it is medicinal too, and it's a little nicer too. It's 23%, if I remember correctly, something like that. It's not like a 40% hard liquor,
but it's highly effective.
And as
we were talking off camera, we were saying, that I know exactly how much of that I can drink to maintain composure, and depending on my scenario.
That, you know, that, that comes from experience and hypothetically slipping up beforehand, too.
Oh, yeah, yeah, you know, when you get out with friends, and, you know, one of the worst things in the world is, I don't know if you smoke pot, but, you know, if you get out for a night of drinking, mm-hmm. and, you know, you're just having a great time, and somebody goes, oh, I got a joint, you want to go smoke? That's the worst thing that can happen to you. Mm-hmm. Because pot these days is so much stronger than it was back then, so that can really wreck your night. So all these life experiences I've encountered, and I've learned to be a more professional drinker and partaker in smoking, and the combination of the two, you know, to maintain the show. Show's got to go on. But I'll tell you, listen, I love to have a shot or two before I go on stage. It's really kind of an important part of my process. So I don't know. Do you do that? You
no, but now I'm interested. I've toured with people that enjoy a little bit of hard liquor right before going on stage, and I'm questioning the Vox part of the podcast here now. Does that something that helps like warm up your throat? Because I've toured with people where they're on stage, and if they're not feeling it, they're screaming for a bottle. They're screaming for a bottle of Jack for their voice.
For me, it's about getting into character and being. I'm so not the person that you know, that voice and that person on stage. I'm just not that person off the stage, and so it really is a role, and part of that role is being terrified. You know, people don't think about, I mean, maybe they do think about it, maybe that's why not everybody does this, what we do, you know, but you got to admit, you know, you walk out in front of a festival of, you know, 30,000 people.
There's always a little goosebumps.
Your knees are a little shaky, you're like, oh, fuck, man, you know, because especially us as singers, mm-hmm. everyone's just fucking staring right at you, and it's it's a little overwhelming, you know, but it's not at all overwhelming if I just have just... If I just round my edges just a little bit, and you know, I don't recommend it for everybody. It's just for me, you know. But everybody has their vices that sort of allow them to get to the level they feel comfortable at. You know, I mean, I definitely, there's nothing worse than seeing somebody all shit faced on stage, though.
That's, no, yes, we've all seen those videos.
So you know, there's a fine line between those things, you know. And because I don't have to play, you know, Atheist is very challenging music, so I don't have to play guitar anymore on stage. So that lightens my load a little bit. It allows me to be a little more colorful, you know.
I have a whole thing about that later. I'll bring it up to that. it is true, though, that having to get into character is something that sometimes it's easy, but sometimes it has to be learned. And sometimes you're going through a shitty day, and the fans that are in the room still deserve that perfect performance from you. And if two shots of Jaeger helps just... snap you into frontman mode, then...
Yeah, it really does. It gives me courage. It's really not about now, you know, I don't, my voice, you know, the voice thing is questionable. Now, when I was in Neurotica and I was singing, it was a little more, I was a little more concerned about, you know, the quality of my voice because I was having to sing where I had to do harmonies and stuff like that.
Some
but
notes, yeah.
With death and thrash metal vocals are, you know, mine are very high and witchy, so if anything, it helps me a little bit. You know, but it really is like, I don't know if you're the kind of singer that you could just on a dime, somebody could be like, oh, give it to me. And you just go, raw. You know, are you that guy?
Yeah, I can probably, the low growl, yeah, 100%, most of the time.
Like, we toured with Vitriol, and I love those guys. I think they're one of the best, best new bands.
I agree.
Their record. Fucking ferocious, man. And if you don't know about them, look them up.
100%. And,
but when we were on the Cattle tour, they were opening. And backstage, those two guys, they have two vocalists. And they're the real fucking deal, man. They sound like goddamn monsters. Oh, and I was like, I envied that. I was like, man, you fucking young bastards. You know,
Kyle,
you just
and
sound
Adam.
Like monsters. Just, yeah, just I love them. They were great. And can't say enough about them. But yeah, I'm not that guy. Like, I've got to. Somebody's got to poke me in the chest to get me to fight. You know what I mean? Like,
That's interesting.
We're all different.
Very, very interesting. Take me to the classic Vox and Hops question. The soundtrack of your youth, when you were growing up in your parents or guardians' house, what music was playing when you were not in control of the radio? What music did your parents or guardians listen to?
Well, my father was only living with us until I was seven. And mm-hmm. so my recollection of him was he literally would play... it was all about Hendrix and Joplin, and he was very machismo about music. So he had a real strong opinion. But looking back on it now, he's passed now. Rest in peace, Dad. But mm-hmm. but he he also would play Richard Pryor tapes for me. You know, 7 years old, you know what I mean? Or he would play them in my presence, I should say.
Yes, exactly.
And so he had a bit of a... my mom was from Kentucky, and she was very sort of country. And sort of this... She's the most like she likes music, but music is so not important to her in her life, which blows my fucking mind because I can't imagine life without music. But for her, if she never had music in her whole life, she wouldn't care, you know. And it was like, wow. But back when she was younger, she listened to a lot of you know, your typical pop, you know. She was dancing and stuff like that. So but when they split up when I was 8 years old, my mom went a little wild and she started hanging around with I think I've told this story a couple of times. Have you ever seen the movie, what is it called? Shit, Mask. Not with Jim Carrey, but the other one with Sam Elliott and Cher.
Yes.
It's a movie called Mask, and yes. It's about a kid with a deformed face. Well, that lifestyle was my lifestyle all of a sudden. So I went from this, my dad was pretty strict, and he was like he's just a different kind of guy. So our household was really kind of vanilla, and then all of a sudden it got very bikerish. And so that's when I learned about Black Sabbath. And
wow.
And so at 8, 9, and 10 years old, I was getting a healthy dose of sex and a lot of music. Not me personally, but just seeing it. And it was pretty debaucherous. My mom is the sweetest lady right now, you know. But, I mean, she hit the ground running when she broke up because she was in hell for 13 years with my father. So bless her heart, man. She deserved it. But I was right there soaking it all in, you know. Yeah. And so, yeah, Black Sabbath, Alice Cooper, and then I in Kansas and Boston and, you know, all that 70s shit. And so that's why, you know, as a death metal guy, I've always felt like I've had a really healthy history of, you know, like I really know where, you know, music comes from. And you know, and I think that's helped Atheist be separated a little bit because I, you know, wrote a lot of the guitar stuff, and there's, you know, quite a few moments where I hear things in Atheist that I know are like
directly something else,
from Sabotage, from Black Sabbath, you know, like which I love that album so much, but I hear things that I stole. It's funny. Do you hear things that you steal?
Yes. I don't necessarily write the music aspect of stuff, but I know that everything is always linked to something else, and that's for sure.
Yeah. Or, you know, even vocally, you may pronounce a word a particular way.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And not even realize it. I didn't realize it as much until I got into my, like, 40s, and I went back and
re-listening to your catalog, yeah.
Like, well, no, re-listening to the shit that I listened to when I was, okay. before yeah. I had a catalog. Like, old Merciful Fate.
Yeah.
I stole so much. Like, musically, I hear things that I stole. Or the idea, the conduct,
yeah.
the technique.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I can hear those things in that, and that. But, I mean, isn't that what all music is?
Totally.
I mean,
that's exactly what I was going to say, for sure.
You know, and so, you know, it's funny how harsh critics are these days, and you're going through it right now. I just put out the Till the Dirt record. I just went through the barrage of everyone's The World According to Everyone.
They're all experts, apparently, now. That's okay. Sure. The internet gives everyone a voice. We choose to listen and or not listen, and that's all. That's all we can do in this aspect of things.
I miss the real journalist, the real music journalist, you know what I mean?
That's true.
Not just the any guy with an IP address, man, you know what I mean? I just miss the guy that actually has a history of, you know, because it's nothing's more annoying than having somebody compare me vocally to a modern singer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just not, like, come on, you know what I mean? It's like you wouldn't go to, like, Rob Halford and say, you sound a little bit like that Jared Leto guy. Like, he'd be like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, that's an odd analogy.
No, I understand. He was a baby when I was doing
it. Come on now. You know what I mean? But I love to tell people where I stole my vocals from. You know, Millet from Creator, fucking Schmier from Destruction.
Yes.
You know, I mean, I was really into that German shit, you know, when I was young. And plus, I didn't have a good high quality deep. So I was like, yeah, the high shit's where I'm at, you know.
Did you fall into, a lot of people fall into being an extreme vocalist because there was no one else to do it? Were you, like, basically the most proficient in the room and they pushed you towards it? Is that your story?
Exactly what. Yeah, in the beginning of Atheist, when we were called Ravage, we had a singer that sounded kind of like Paul Di'Anno.
Mm-hmm.
And once we cleared from him, I just gave it a shot. You know, I just jumped on the mic and kind of gave it a shot, and then we ended up, and that's how it ended up. So I bet that happens a lot, though. How did you end up doing it? You
don't play music at all. I always wanted to be a singer. No, I
Do you sing as well?
I am a clean vocalist, primarily. I took some Broadway training.
Nice.
Voice lessons when I was young to keep me in shape. My aunt actually bought me voice lessons when I was very, very 18, when I was just starting out doing bands. A new metal child, I'll admit it. Into all of that. I was 16 in 1999, you know, so just loved that shit growing up. And then just more and more started listening to more and more extreme stuff, and I fell into being a death metal vocalist. It's just unbelievable.
Well, yeah, so what band was it that really kind of, to where you went?
The trigger of the extreme low growl was, it's a later album too, because I'm so young, was Kill from Cannibal Corpse, and George's delivery on it is just unbelievable.
Yeah. And
that really, really changed.
And so what did you do? You go in your room and just try it, and you're like, oh shit, I
was in
too.
A band at the time already, so I just tried bringing in these elements. We were in a metalcore band. We were in a Killswitch Engage worship band before I was in Cryptopsy. And I just tried to bring in these new elements of a low guttural growl, which I already had like a few little things because I like to mess with my voice, like very heavy Mike Patton influence. So I would
love Mike Patton.
Already mess around with weird voices, and a low growl was there. But to have such a consistent enunciated bark, let's say, is something that really came from George and that Kill album for sure.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things that's really separates, because there's everybody's got it, you know, these days there's everybody's got the, you know, the voice or whatever, but it's that enunciation is really, really important. I saw you guys play it was in Tampa, and after the show it was at a point, I'm trying to think of the time period, but I remember asking Flo to play drums. I needed a drummer, and I was like, Flo, would you play drums for Atheist? He's like, shit, man. He's like, I just agreed to do the he's
the
doing
ultimate.
The thing with David, yeah. And he's like, oh, I'd love to do that. And I was like, because I just, you know, he's obviously, Steve Flynn, our original drummer, was always a fan of Flo. And, you know, and it's just, he's just an incredible player. But, you know, vocally, I always wonder how, you know, and what is that turning point? I don't even remember my turning point of, I guess it was just Creator. I think Pleasure to Kill was just like,
he's saying something. I can understand what he's saying.
Yeah, that and who else was really, really great at enunciation? I mean, these days, like in modern vocalists, that's something I think is really separates the men from the boys. You know what I mean? Being able to understand is like so damn important. You know, because
I spend a lot of time in studio on the new record, making sure everything.
Well, I know what I was saying as I saw your performance, and you know, it's funny having this conversation with you right now. It's remarkable how different you are. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? How and it's something I always tell people in that are outside of the metal realm. Like, if you would be blown away at the guys that are at the top of the game, if you had a conversation with them, there's this preconception of
we're evil, horrible monsters, yeah,
knuckle dragging dum-dums. You know, it's like, you know, and so I remember going to Wacken in 2006 and looking up over the horizon at all the black shirts, which is just something to behold. Anybody that's ever gone to Wacken, it is literally like an entire city of our people. You know what I mean? If you wear a yellow shirt in that place, you
could tell you're fine, at least.
Yeah, you could be like, yo, I'm going to dip out 400 yards this way. I'll wave my hand. You'll see me.
Exactly.
But, yeah, you know, I mean, but your performance on stage was like, there's so many, I use this term, but it's not used, the modern kids use the term shoegazing a lot. But I see, you know, there's a lot of singers that don't know what to do themselves. You know, I think you subscribe to the same thing that I do, is that you're the front man. You're the MC. You will listen to me. You will put your fucking hands in the air.
It's our job. It's half the job. You know, like the guys, and, their hands are busy. Mine aren't.
So. I always respect that, you know, because I think that's one of the things that I felt has separated me a little bit from sort of modern guys. That's, you know, I'm not interested in looking evil or you know what I mean, any of those things, but I am interested in being involved. You know what I mean? I need everybody involved here. We're all fucking in this room together. Let's get it together, you know? And I think that comes from that old school rock, that you know, watching old school frontmen sort of command the show, and including our friend Dee Snider.
Hell yes. Oh, he's a killer.
In all fairness, you know?
It's funny you got signed to WWE, because a lot of the time, and I'm not in, a lot of things have changed as I'm getting older, and as one of them is I'm getting into birding. letting a lot go on the podcast today. I'm getting into birding. I'm more interested in birds as I get older. And another thing that I'm interested in again is when I grew up, wrestling was huge, right? So I'm finding myself getting back into wrestling. And as I'm looking at these guys, and there's so much of us being a frontman is so close to wrestling.
Yeah.
The persona on stage and the entertaining the crowd. And building a set is the same way of building, let's say, a match. It's something that I've been thinking about recently in my, as I'm getting older.
Do you know who else is, you know, else is great is Jason from Origin.
Oh yeah.
You know what I mean?
Kaiser like he is has, awesome.
Well, the reason, well, there's a directorial aspect to it that I think all the best frontmen have, where you're helping everybody follow along.
Because some people don't know what to do.
They don't. And then, so when you watch somebody who's like, you know, Frank Mullen, this is historical.
Yeah.
You know, this is like a timing, you know, for everybody out there that can't follow along. You know, and I love that shit, man. Yeah. I love, you know, because there's just not enough of that. Because there's always been this stigma of, well, we got to keep it real. You know, we got to keep it small and sort of understated as extreme metal. It could be flamboyant.
No.
It could be a little more... You know,
I think so. It could be theatrical, almost.
Absolutely.
And I really do think that a crowd, a lot of the times, and I'll watch a crowd when I'm not on the stage, and the crowd is just waiting for permission.
Yep, and direction.
Yeah.
Like, They want to move. Are we going fast now? Are we going fast? Let's go fast.
We just did Saudi Arabia, and I was given like a rule book of what I couldn't do on stage. It wasn't that bad. It wasn't too bad. I couldn't swear, and I couldn't tell the crowd to move. And that was like something like that I'm so ingrained in me. Not necessarily the swearing, but the making a crowd move. But they moved themselves, so it was okay.
I have to ask you, because that just happened a few weeks ago, right?
Yeah, it was early December, yeah.
That's balls, dude.
It was crazy.
That is balls to go there. I mean, just to fly. Like, we as a band couldn't go. You couldn't put Atheist on a marquee in Saudi Arabia. Yeah,
exactly.
That would absolutely be very unsafe for us. So yeah.
We were talking about Aborted, too. Aborted, I don't think we'll ever make it out there.
Cryptopsy, they were like, you know, I don't know what the word for that. Did you ask what the word for that is? And...
I didn't actually know. That would have been an interesting question.
I wonder what that is. But they put your name right on the marquee, though.
It was a room that did not have a marquee, I'll say that. I'll be honest. It wasn't the biggest room, but it was still a good room.
What a gig, man.
It was crazy.
What a box to check off.
Yeah, it was an experience.
As a young metal guy, that you never imagined.
Never.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to roll out in Saudi Arabia. Like, I mean, that's just crazy.
And I'm going to go, and...
Yeah, I mean, so what were the kids like?
And it was exactly the same. I've toured all over the world, and it's always the same. A crowd is always the same.
They were allowed to wear, like, black shirts?
They wore black shirts. They had their hair down. They headbanged. Other people were in full religious attire.
They had their hair down?
Yeah.
They had long hair and shit?
Yeah. Yeah. In the past 5 years, Saudi Arabia has opened up a lot. So the religious police doesn't exist anymore from what I saw and what I was told. We were actually brought out there by a girl named Gigi. It's a girl that runs Heavy Arabia that brought us out there, which is amazing.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
Man, that's what a
it
dream
was crazy.
Gig. I mean, I would definitely be terrified a little bit, but I'd be so intrigued. What a gift, like, you as a young metalhead could never, I mean, whenever could we imagine being,
no.
You know, and all the other cool places we all get to go
exactly.
to as well. I mean, and then
we beat Metallica going there, which was also a nice little thing, but.
Yes.
It was a good press headline, I'll say that. Thank you, Frank, for Metal Injection for making that spread around for me. Back to your voice. I totally gave him everything. Back to your voice.
Did you plan it at TMZ?
I totally did. Back to your voice. Talk to me about discovering this voice, and I wanted to say this too because I listened to it again today. Back in that era, I've toured with Obituary. And the Tardy didn't know what he was saying. He was just screaming sounds. Right. Whereas something that you really came across, and we spoke about it before, was the enunciation of pronouncing just so well the whole time. What was that difference of, like, you back then? You know, Chuck obviously had a sort of similar staccato, high, aggressive vocals like you. That's also very well enunciated. Where did that all come from, and that how did that all stem from you? It's just something that came at you naturally. Very powerful vocals, as I was listening at the time today.
Well, thank you. I think that I was just trying to find my way, but I'm a huge fan of Rush, and really? You know, and I always thought lyrically, you know, Neil Peart, the stuff he wrote was just beautiful and poetic, and
so I really want that now, with everything now. Now it makes sense.
I want to write things that are if I'm going to write things that are interesting, I want to be able to have them be understood as much as possible. So one of the things I've noticed that a lot of people, when I see lyric videos that are modern, I realize that a lot of people will split a word between two sentences, which is something I would never do.
I don't think I would do that either. Yeah.
And so there would be no way that you could figure out what that fucking word was if you were just listening along. You didn't have Google to pull it up. So when I was younger, like, the only way you could figure out what somebody was saying was if they told you the lyrics were on the album or whatever. But to split a word between two phrases is really strange to me. So anyway, I guess I probably have a full interest in being understood. So and singing as well, instead of screaming. When you're singing, it's really important to enunciate in order to hit the note that you want to hit. You know,
I love that vowel. You got to get the vowel to vibrate there.
Yeah, to reach that that note. So so probably from that. But you know, at the time, all of our contemporaries, you know, Obituary, Deicide, you know, Nasty Savage, we were all coming from different ball fields, but it was all under the same, I don't know, the same philosophy. You know, it was just such a weird time back then. It was
so cold. It's unbelievable what Florida had, and then, you know, San Francisco with thrash, Montreal with death metal, now in like the 2000s, and with Gorguts and Cryptopsy and all that. Just unbelievable how these little, let's call it a hotbed, happens. And there's no recipe to create a hotbed. It just happens.
Yeah, and it's beautiful to be a part of it.
It's,
you know,
I mean?
Because you don't realize it's happening when it's happening. Mm-hmm. You just think that that's what's going on everywhere. And but you know, we definitely, there's always been this signature West Coast California thrash sound, and there's always been that Southern Florida nasty swamp death metal. Like, people were just like, "What the fuck is going on down there?" But you know, it wasn't like everybody sounded the same.
No, and it's you know, and Florida is not a big place. You can drive across it in a day, less than a day, and to have that many different entities come out from one small place, yet you guys are all probably being influenced by each other, happy sense of competition with each other.
Competition, definitely, but I don't know about influence from me. I think we all are children of Nasty Savage. You know, all the actual, you know, because they just really encompassed this violent showman, but technical. Like, they, you know, if you listen to the riffs, the guitarists, there's some really great guitarists. Now, you know, Ronnie's vocals are also sort of from what was happening before that. So how old are you?
I'm 40 years old this year.
Okay, so yeah. So back then it was like power metal and bands with great singers. Like, Crimson Glory used to practice like a couple doors away from us. And they got signed to Atlantic. And we were down in our warehouse and we were just like, fuck, man. You know, just watching them go off on tour with Metallica. And there was Sabotage.
Yeah.
And so that was what was happening in Florida. It was all about, you know, good-looking dudes fucking that could sing their ass off. And we were just back there like, and so, you know, at the time it seemed like, oh, man. But so that's what makes me really proud of me and my friends, is that we were all like, fuck that. You know, we're going to stick to our guns. We're going to play fast. And, you know, we just love that aggression so much that, you know, that we trudged on past what was happening at the time. So Nasty Savage was right in the middle, because Ronnie's vocals had like a I don't know, he had that wrestling quality to him, you know, as a front man. But then his vocals, he had a, like, you know, that high vocal. But musically, it was moving, and it wasn't, you know, super fast or anything. But, you know, Morbid Angel really kind of set that up, you know. And then Obituary was called Executioner at that time. And, you know, we all did. I remember a huge hotel party that happened. That it was like Rocky Point Beach Resort, it was called, and Massacre played, Sabotage, I think, played, Nasty Savage played, Morbid Angel played. It was like this crazy Quentin Tarantino scene in a motel on the beach in Florida with all this weird ass music. Like, yeah, it was so cool, man. And so we were still unsigned at that point, so we were like, you know, like, wow. And it was just, you know, when it's happening, you don't realize that it's sort of happening. I mean, you're having fun, you're looking around, but it's so cool, man, to look back 30 years now and run into Mike Browning, you know what I mean, and be like, what's up? And we're all gray haired, and we're, you know, but we're still fucking banging it out, you know what yeah. I mean? Like, nobody would have ever guessed that you know, that alumni would still be banging it out at a top level, you know what I mean, these days. I mean, Cannibal Corpse has been around for a fucking ever. You know, and but it was competitive, not in a negative way at all.
No.
Scott Burns really loved it. You know, as a producer, he was just like, "What a dream, man!" You know, I mean, I had all these great bands right at my fingertips to produce differently. You know, mm-hmm. There's an Obituary record and an Atheist record are two totally different animals that he, you know, and then he captured, you know, jump over, do Sepultura yeah. and do Death. You know, I mean, there's four different animals
that's
all in the same vicinity, kind of, you know, so that was kind of cool, you know.
About production, I want to hit on that, because you handle production back in the day, you handle production now. Talk to me about that, the evolution of production, and just, you know, because back in the day, the Morris Sound, there was no guidebook. There was no YouTube tutorials of how to record fast drums. You guys had to learn how to do this yourselves and find a way to make it work. And nowadays, everything is a lot, especially in the mid-2000s, 2010s. Everything was really fake for a long time. Now it's trickling back to becoming more organic, but it's never going to be as organic as it used to be. So talk to me about the evolution of production and your involvement in it. Is it something you still love? Let's just go with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, one of the things you touch on there is, you know, it'll never be the same, but as a result of the production advancements, music changed. Because, you know, you could never have the kind of double bass drumming that happens now. Flo Monnet could not be who he is if technology didn't change. And that's not a slight on Flo in any way. It's just to say that Flo and his contemporaries recognized the ability to clean up that sound. Now, Scott Burns and Morris Sound were game changers back in the day, because you had a lot of German thrash, a lot of, you know, West Coast thrash, and the kick drum, you know, if you listen to Kill 'Em All, you know, even Rain and Blood, you know, Angel of Death, that's a real, you know, that's before triggers. Mm-hmm. And so that's about as fast as you can go without it sounding wonky.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And as soon as that got honed in, it's like somebody gave a really brilliant artist a better paintbrush.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And that grew.
What can you paint with this now? Yeah.
Yeah. Unbelievable, like, turn of events. You know, drummers now are just fucking stunning. You know, and so that was never a possibility back then. But I've always been one of the reasons why we worked with Scott was we heard the Obituary demo, and we were like, oh, my God, you can hear the digga 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 digga. We were like, ah, oh, you can hear it, you know, because you couldn't really hear it on like Sodom and old recordings. Something, you know, it was kind of messy. You could tell it was double bass,
but it was lost in the mix there.
Yeah, and so and that wasn't even that fast. So as speed became more and more prevalent, it was important for those production things to jump like that. So, and now I'm just 100% blown away, and so is Scott Burns. Like, I can tell you, we just did this Till the Dirt record together. It came out last year in Nuclear Blast, and when I sent him the demos that I did on my laptop, he was like, the fucking drums sound amazing. He's like, I can't believe that you did those drums on your laptop. And I'm like, I know, dude, I'm just as old as you are, man. I'm fucking like, if I had this when I was a kid, exactly. I would have wrote 100 albums.
Exactly. To wait, you know, for, I mean, anyone. You didn't have to wait for a drummer to show up. You
know? Or, here, drummer, play this 100 times in a row. Play this for the next 10 minutes so I can work out this guitar riff. Like,
yeah.
that's that alone, like those things are like so game changing, man. And I as soon as COVID hit, I got a setup, a little DAW setup, and I got the STL Tone Hub guitar stuff. And Scott Burns sent me a bass, and off I went. I wrote like 25 songs in like six
Holy
weeks.
Holy shit. That's where Till the Dirt came from.
Yeah, yeah. I played all the guitar and programmed the drums and did all and put it all together in the demo. And then when Scott became involved, you know, I was in the middle of songs and he was helping me as an actual producer. Instead of back in the day, he was engineering and then kind of producing as well. So this was a different role for him because technology had gone to a level that had surpassed him just being able to jump back into the game. You know, he's an old school producer that works on tape, you know, tape and the way things used to be analog. So, but he was just so even. You know, even now he was able to jump back in his ears. Like, there's such value to good ears, you know, good producers. Like,
they hear things that we don't hear.
Yeah, absolutely
they
do.
Really
and,
do. Yeah.
And so he was just so helpful to me. And plus, it was encouraging because he hasn't wanted to work on anything in so long. So when I sent him the demos, he wasn't real happy initially that I was going to send him music because we had had such a great conversation on the phone and he didn't want to ruin it by telling me that my new shit sucked.
You don't got it anymore.
He was like, yeah, you know, he's like, it had happened to him a couple times over the years. And he was like, this was such a great conversation. I was bummed when you were like, oh, I've got some new music. Can I send it to you? And I was like, oh, man. So, you know, we laugh about it now, but he was just like, how did you record it? So anyway, I love the idea. Now, you know, and I, there's really no reason why a young musician these days can't make their statement without the help of a label, without the help of real finance. And you can do it. If you got it, you can do it and you need to do it. Like the technology is available to you, right on your laptop, man. You can get your point across musically in a way that I can't tell you the primitive nature of four track in the 1986, like where you do four tracks and you bounce three over and then
track.
It's like, yeah, it was like, you know, but isn't it funny though? You think about those Beatles records, man.
Yeah.
And Pink Floyd. Like Pink Floyd, man, those records still sound so fucking good. Like, so clear at loud volumes, amazing. So production is a really important tool, you know, that I'm not a tech head in any way. Like, I still use monitors. I don't use an in-ear monitor. I'm just not a technical, but I hate reading directions for anything. You know what I mean? I don't know what it is. I don't really want to know how something works. I just like it to work. If I turn it on, I need it to work.
If
my car breaks down, like, and somebody's going to fix my car, and they'll tell me what's wrong with it, I'm like, can you just fix it? That'd be cool. I really don't. They'll be like, oh, you know, this cord over here goes to the carburetor, and there's a... I don't really care. Guitar-wise, too, like, I couldn't fix a guitar. My life depended on it, but I played one for 30 years, and I know how to fucking play the shit out of it. I can change the strings, but I can't set my intonation. I couldn't build a guitar if my life depended on it. So I'm a weird character that way. Like, I'm just not really into details.
As long as you know yourself, that's important.
Hey, what's up, Vox and Hopsins? I just want to take a little moment about Cryptopsy's upcoming tours. That's right, I'm talking about the Scream of Perseverance tour and our headliner dates that coincide with that tour called As Summer Burns. The Scream of Perseverance tour is kicking off at the end of May and runs all the way until the end of June. We are supporting the mighty Death to All. We are going all over the United States and we are hitting some of Canada. So excited to be honoring the legendary music of Death alongside amazing musicians that performed on these albums. Even more stoked to be doing some headliner dates in some cities that I've actually never played in. If you are planning to come to any of these shows, you should definitely grab your tickets by going to voxandhops.com/summer and you will be able to grab all of your tickets there. That's voxandhops.com/summer. Do it, people. Come hang out with me. Enjoy life, metal, and craft beer in your hometown. Come to a show. We're going to have a great time. Now, enough about all of that. Let's get back to the episode.
Take me to that moment. As I was setting up for this, I didn't know as much as I should about you, is that you did used to play guitar and you had to stop.
No, I never stopped. I just stopped on stage.
Exactly. But that must have been a moment of like, did you have to mourn that part of your stage persona?
No, I actually celebrated it. Okay. to be honest.
A bit more freedom because your hands
Yeah, man. I mean, God, that was hard. You know,
you also mentioned that you could partake a little bit more in the beforehand.
But honestly, as much as I'd love to be a rock star and say that was one of the reasons, it's not. No, it was just, it was hard. The atheist music was difficult. And that's what gave me the carpal tunnel of my thumb. It just hurt so bad. And there was also an element where I didn't, you know, maybe these days the technology is better medically to have it fixed and have it be okay. But I was like, listen, I could still play guitar. I just got to sit down to play.
Yeah.
So if I sit down, I can sit for 6 hours and play. But if
it's
I stand
just that
up,
angle for some reason. It just throws everything off.
Well, it's because I had bad posture singing and playing that crazy ass shit. You know, and not having proper. Nobody ever taught me how to play guitar. I never learned how to read music or any of that shit. So it was all. And so I was just trying to get through it, man.
Intuition, you know,
I was just trying to. There's a lot of shit going on, and especially with atheists, there was a lot of opposite shit going on. And so I'm, you know, and the drums at the time were. Wasn't like it was a solid fucking 4/4 rolling for me all the time. So it was like tightrope walking all the time. Like, oh, fuck, man. And that mentally would scare the shit out of me.
Oh, yeah.
We played one time in New Orleans with Exhorter. When Exhorter first got signed, and we first got signed, we were both on Godly Records, which was Borivoj's label that he worked at. And you remember Exhorter, right?
Yes, of course.
Yeah. So, and this is like pre-Pantera, you know, Exhorter, like, they're a fucking killer. And still are, but. So, we're at the Storyville Jazz Theater. It's our first road trip as a band. You know, I mean, part of us rode up in the back of a pickup truck, and the other part of us rode up in a car. Yeah, it was old school.
One of those, yeah.
So we get there, and I'm like, all right, man, I got to change my strings. And these guys come over, and they're like, yo, you want to get high? And I was like, hey, you got some pot? Sweet. We don't have any pot. We didn't want to travel with any because we didn't want to get in trouble. So I get in the car with these fucking guys, man, and it's about 4 hours before we're supposed to play. And we smoke a joint, and I'm starting to feel like really weird. Long story short, man, they put cocaine in that fucking joint, man. And I was like, and it was a really important gig because it was like, it was a, you know, we were just about to get signed, and, you know, and plus there's like, you know, we're playing with Exhorter, and if we suck, he's going to tell Bori, and we were just like, oh my God. And I couldn't put my strings on, man. I was like, I couldn't, I was so like, I mean, you know, they put like, it tasted different. Like, the joint tasted really weird and different. I should have known better. But by the time they got me back there, I was pretty jacked up, man. And I had a really difficult time. That was a moment where I was just like, oh, man, this is so stressful to worry about my amp, whether I'm in tune, pulling off the riffs. Yeah, playing.
Following the drummer.
So the idea of, you know, not playing was... mentally, I was like, okay, I could do it. Now, the first time we did it, we toured with Benediction in 93, and I didn't know what to do with my fucking hands. So as a singer, I was just like, you can watch the video of me just like trying to figure out what to do with my hands. My whole time of playing, like
your
I'm
hands
just so
are, used, are, just start floating.
I had to learn, man. It was it was this weird process, and it is something that, you know, that's another great thing about you. Very natural movement. That's so important.
Well, for a long time, it was connected to my mic cord for some reason.
Yeah, I don't mind like hanging on to like wrapping around my arm.
I think that's the first.
I don't like a wireless mic. I can't do the wireless mic because I need that cord. I like to just hang on to it every now and then and just, you know, it's just I don't know. It's still weird. You know, I love talking to other singers because you can kind of find out whether we.
I'm still on a wired mic. I don't use a wireless.
Yeah, I'm with you, man.
How can I do Slit Your Guts where I pull the wire out of my guts? Come on, with me.
No, he sucks at a festival too because it's pretty hard to have a wire at a festival.
I know. I was just talking to I'm sponsored by endorsed by Audio Technica, and the guys keep saying you need to get a wireless from them.
It's
for
like, no,
festivals.
You need a 90 foot cord.
Exactly, those are expensive. It's true though. It's true because it literally just happened in Mexico that my cord was just long enough. It was ridiculous.
Here's the thing: maybe we could invent like a 3 foot extension that comes off of a wireless for us to hang on to.
Hell yeah.
Because that's all it's really about.
Exactly.
It's just having something to hang on to.
Like a whip.
If it goes down to your knees, you can fucking wrap it up and...
you know, Chuck Billy has that. Up, Chuck Billy has that little stand that's sick. He's got his thing.
Yeah. Well, that's happened to me inadvertently. Like, I'm really hard on mic stands for some reason. I had to buy a couple on the last tour, and I don't mean to. It's just that most of the, you know, from playing some of these clubs, man, some of the mic stands they give you are shit.
Yes.
And I need a straight stand. I can never have a boom. Mm-hmm. And do you use a straight stand as well?
I don't use a stand anymore. No.
Oh, yeah, at all?
No.
Oh, what do you do with the mic when you're just dicking around?
That's it. Yeah.
You just hang on to it?
I hang on to it and headbang.
You don't ever want to put it down?
Very rarely, no. I've never had the... Sometimes I'll put it down when I jump in the crowd, but I don't do that very often.
It's like sometimes I put it down when I jump in the crowd.
Which doesn't happen very often, but sometimes it happens. If I know they're going to catch me. You know,
I jumped in the crowd one time in my whole career, and that was at Hellfest, and I had my passport in my back pocket.
No.
It was terrifying.
You didn't lose it, though.
What an ignorant idiot. I didn't think, about it.
In moments like you don't think about things like that.
It was Steve Flynn, our drummer, afterward. He goes, "Nice job, dummy. You would have been fucking stuck in France." And they're like, yeah. Anybody could have pulled that out of your pocket.
My God.
Like, oh, man.
Speaking about Europe and actually not France. Sorry, France.
I know. And Spain. Sorry. So many letters from everybody going, "Oh, man."
We are hitting Europe together. The Unquestionable Blasphemy Tour 2024 is starting on February 25th to March 24th. We're going all over Europe. It's going to be a blast together. Talk to me about returning to Europe for the first time in 12 years.
Also the UK.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, we've never played Northern Ireland. Scotland. Yeah. So excited to go there. But, as I was, written about, we were supposed to go over last tour at the end of 2022. Mm-hmm. And 2 days before that tour, we were supposed to leave for that tour. One of the guys in the band just decided, "I'm not going. I can't go. I don't feel good about this." There was a lot of weird reasons why, like the war, we're going to be in Poland. I was just like, what? And mm-hmm. It was just real rookie shit. And so I was left without a band, it was really nothing I could do about it. It was catastrophic, and I, apologized to all the fans that I couldn't really talk about it at the time, there was a lot of reasons why I couldn't really say what happened, and also didn't kind of want to, but it was one of the most devastating things to ever happen in my professional career, other than losing our bass player, Roger Patterson. I felt in that moment like, I don't know if I can fucking do this. I can't. You know how hard it is to book a tour, to just to be able to tour. And everybody's in. Everybody agrees. All right, we're going. The tickets are bought. The bus is paid for. Everything. All right, here we go. 48 hours. I'm not going to do it. What?
Yeah.
Like, a couple of the other guys in the band also weren't going to do it unless that guy was going to do it. They didn't feel comfortable about it because the material's hard to play, so you can't just like drop in anybody to play it. Exactly. So I get that. But I had a guy in Boston that could have filled that position, and we should have been able to do it. But, anyway, that's the short story of it, and it was devastating to me personally. So please know, anybody that bought a ticket for that, that sees the cancellation, I read a lot of things online. They were hurtful because people were like, "Oh, I bet it was about money." It's never about fucking money for death metal. So look in my eyes right now and just know that anybody that plays death metal can give me a fucking high five and say, "Yeah, it's not, it should never be about that." I would never cancel a tour 48 hours. I know, I've been doing this for too long, but so that's really what happened. And it was difficult. So I immediately had to put together a brand new band and so I was determined to find the best guys, man. There's really, really cool people that I could love and live with. And I have a band now. This was, there were people that told me when that shit happened. Actually, Schmier from Destruction wrote me a letter when it happened. Yeah. And he's like, "Kelly, you can't have these young guys in your band. You got to get seasoned veterans, And I was like, yeah, but those are difficult too, man. Because
come with egos and they come with baggage.
Kids and bills and wives and things, So there's this catch 22. So you're going to get it from either age group, but I'd rather get the vicious talent of a 25-year-old monster. And so I all the guys in the band are in their mid-20s to early 30s. And they're younger than the music they're playing.
Which is incredible. I think that's so cool.
Yeah, it's wild. But they play it better than we played it. I mean, they honestly, you know, and it's not a slight on the original band. It's just that we had a lot of problems. You know, the original guys, you know, Rand was a tremendous guitar player, but some, not always. You know, not if he had a bad night. You know what I mean? And he was kind of sloppier. Today's musicians are just more disciplined, so there's less slop and more. And so I've found, just as a guy that gets to now stand at the front of the stage, that these young guys with their technical ability are playing this shit so tightly that it, you know, the production on those records, those Atheist records, come from the 90s. You know, you got to be a lover of metal to appreciate the, you know, because you compare it to the quality of today. Like, you can listen to serious, you know, liquid metal, and then you hear an old school song, and then you hear a new song. It's like, holy shit! You know, the production, the you know, it's a big difference.
It's a different era. It's
so. But when you hear those Unquestionable Presence songs or Piece of Time songs on stage with modern PA and great precision picking and players, holy fuck! It moves those songs in a different way. And I even told Steve Flynn, our original drummer, he's very supportive of, because he was never able to tour, and he has a big family and a great job, corporate job, but he's always been super supportive of me, and so I was like, I want to put together a bunch of young assassins, you know, and then go play this music really, really well. And that's what I feel like I have with these guys. You know, they're just so good, and they're so sweet, and they're amazing. You're gonna love them. You know, we're gonna live together for a month. So
we are gonna live together for a month. I'm looking very much forward to it. We're hitting Europe, people. So if you're listening to this in Europe, come and hang out with us.
Yes, please do. We're gonna have a lot of fun.
It's gonna be a lot of fun. We're gonna just paint Europe with wonderful death metal. I'm very much looking forward to it.
I'm a really hands-on person too. I have a lot of relationships with people that I've spoken with but never met.
Over the last
20 years. Yeah, I'm looking forward to meeting those people. You know, I mean, I don't hide out on the bus, or I don't hide out anywhere. I like to come out and meet people. That's why I like going on tour. It's the perk. You know, you meet so many interesting people, and then, you know, there's a couple along the way there, you know.
Yeah, every crowd has a punisher. But
here, sign these 100 posters for me. No, man. We'll do a shot. We'll do a shot, man. I'm not going to sign 100 posters for you.
just everyone listening, bring Kelly some Jägermeister, and yes, you guys know what I want. Bring me some nice craft beers, please, and we'll have a good night.
Oh, you're going to get hooked up. You know, you probably already got your connections already. Even going at it.
One last question, classic Vox and Hops wrap up question. Something that we will not have to do on tour, because we're going to be so responsible and listen to that limit that you were speaking about before. But every once in a while, it happens to everyone, and typically it's when we take that ferry to go into London for some reason, historically with Cryptopsy. What is your hangover cure?
It's a good question. I mean, I drink a lot of Mountain Dew.
Oh, interesting.
So Mountain Dew is, and I mean, when I say I drink a lot of Mountain Dew, like, I am such a, like, I once I land on a brand, man, I land on a brand. I mean, you can look at pictures of me from 1989.
And you're still drinking Mountain Dew?
It's sitting on my amp, yeah.
Really? And Mountain Dew, as opposed to other soft drink, has a bunch of caffeine in it. Is that?
Oh, yeah.
Caffeine and way more sugar. Is that?
Well, now these days, at 55, I've got my diet kicking. So I've got, and I usually drink the zero. So I've gotten rid of the sugar, but the caffeine is still there. That's why I can drink the Jaeger with the Red Bull. The caffeine and the alcohol kind of, you know, they kind of balance out, you know, so I'm fired up, but fucking hammered. Not hammered, but you know what I'm saying, like, feeling good.
You got a good buzz, yeah.
And, I'm a professional partier. You'll find me to be quite, you know, fun. I'm fun when I'm
looking,
you know,
I'm looking forward to it.
When my edges are rounded. You know?
So a Mountain Dew would be your hangover cure.
That's my go-to, with a little bit of, you know, from vocally, throat coat right out of the gate. Hit the throat coat in the morning. And roll with my tea during
that is
the day.
That is something that I do too. Yeah.
And I learned that from Ozzy, man. I not directly. Ozzy didn't be like, oh, drinking it. But I saw him drinking it on stage, and I was like, what the fuck is that? Orange stuff in the cup. And so our tour manager at the time, I was like, can you find out what that is? And he went, he's like, they have it at catering. Ozfest was so sweet, man. That was like another life. That was like above ground instead of underground.
That's,
you know?
So cool, yeah.
Oh my
we'll
God,
have to talk like a lot about that on tour.
It was like a cafeteria every day, a school cafeteria, except that Rob Zombie was there and fucking all these, you know, it was like a cool cafeteria.
A cool cafeteria.
But they had a catering, you know, all these different kinds of teas, but throat coat. And man, that shit is miraculous.
It works, yeah.
That thing has pulled me through some throat coat. If you want to throw some money towards our tour, I'll wear a fucking throat coat shirt. Because I haven't been able to get through some shows because of that. I mean, that really got me. They don't get you 45 minutes.
No, it totally. It makes you just puts you right in the zone for some reason.
Yeah, it just loops up your cords and gets it done. I don't know what the fuck's in it, but it's really. And I've tried other teas. People go, oh, here, try this, try that.
No, I like throat coat the best.
Yeah, it has something about it.
It has elmwood bark. I think that's one of the main ingredients, if I remember correctly.
Elmwood bark?
I feel like that might be it. We'll have to check it out.
What kind of guy is Flo?
Flo's a chill guy. He's a chill guy. He likes to drink a few Coors Light and listen to Boston. You mentioned Boston before, and I was going to... He likes his Boston. He likes his Chicago.
More than a feeling.
Exactly.
That's funny. Coors Light in Boston. That is not what I anticipated.
He works out.
He's a good-looking man. He's a good-looking man.
We're going to have a good time. Kelly, thank you so much for taking the time, hanging out with me, talking about your life, talking about music. Talking a little bit about craft beer, a little bit of Jaeger, talking a lot about our upcoming Unquestionable Blasphemy tour that's coming up real soon.
I'm starting in Berlin.
Hell,
right?
Yes.
Berlin is the first show. Right?
I feel like the first show you might be right, but I feel like it's Copenhagen, but I could be wrong.
I think Copenhagen, yeah, one of those. We'll be there. We'll
definitely be there together. If it's in Berlin, where I know where I'm going, because I know that craft beer. And if it's in Copenhagen, I know where I'm going too. Massive cheers to you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, thank you all so much for listening right to the end. You know that I love and appreciate that. Man, I am so excited to go on tour with Kelly, especially after this conversation. I literally wrapped up and grabbed my phone and texted the Cryptopsy guy saying how cool he was. I am sincerely looking forward to playing so many gigs across Europe. The Unquestionable Blasphemy Tour. So damn stoked to be returning to Europe, and I'm stoked to spend each night traveling alongside Kelly and the rest of the Atheist dudes. We're going to have such a blast. You should grab your tickets if you have not already, because it's going to be such a killer time. You can go and grab all of your tickets by going to voxandhops.com/Europe. That's voxandhops.com/Europe. If you are coming to a gig, let me know. We can hang out. We can drink a beer. Bring some Jaeger. For Kelly, as I mentioned, it's going to be such a blast. Massive cheers for Kelly for hanging out with me. I am so goddamn stoked that we did this. Now, if you enjoyed this Vox and Hops episode, you should sign up to the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast mailing list. You can do that on my website, voxandhops.com. That's voxandhops.com. And when you do that, you shall receive one email a week that contains all of the details of everything that has happened in the world of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast. You will get to see which episodes I dropped recently. You will also get to see which episodes I have coming up. You will get to hear about any projects I have in the works for the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, and you will also be updated on whatever I got going on with Cryptopsy. That's right. Cryptopsy, we just dropped our brand new album back in September of 2023, and we are doing a whole bunch of stuff. We are planning a massive 2024, starting with that European tour, the Unquestionable Blasphemy Tour with Atheists that's coming up at the end of February. It's running all across Europe until the end of March. You also get to see which albums the Vox and Hops album review crew have reviewed recently, and you will get to see which albums Jerry Monk, Vox and Hops' metal architect, has added to the Brutal Awakenings playlist. There's always a lot of stuff going on in the world of the Vox and Hops Metal Podcast, and I hate when you miss a single thing, so do me a favor and sign up to the mailing list. The Vox and Hops Metal Podcast is brought to you by Sound Talent Media and Evergreen Podcasts. I hope you have a killer rest of the week. I will be back next week on Tuesday with yet again another episode. But until then, remember to enjoy life, metal, and craft beer. Cheers, Vox and Hops heads.
Bowie, Dylan, Marley. You've heard the names and maybe you've heard their songs, but what about the stories behind the records that made titans of music like these so universally loved and important? Join me, Josh Adam Myers, host of The 500, as each week I go through a different album from Rolling Stone magazine's 500 Greatest Albums list from 2012 with an incredible lineup of comedians, actors, and musicians talking about how the music has impacted their lives. New episodes of The 500 come out every Wednesday. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.